I recently had the privilege of meeting a woman who is discerning a vocation to religious life. She asked me if I would share my story with her because she's feeling attracted to both the contemplative and the active life and would like to know how to hear the Lord more clearly. I decided to prepare for this with some notes so I don't wander off on some tangent and consume her entire evening. Since I expect I'll be asked the same question in the future, I'm turning on my microphone to record my story. Spoiler alert. First spoiler. If you or your friend or your child are feeling a possible call to religious life, you must realize that every path is unique. Listening to one person's story may not be of any help whatsoever. Second spoiler. The angel Gabriel appeared to the Virgin Mary, but I've never heard of anybody else. Even great saints who received the call to consecrated life through a visit of an angel to their bedroom. Forget it. It's not going to happen. The call is going to be more subtle. Anyway, Mary and Joseph had already felt that inner call to consecrated chastity, which is why Mary, a Jewess, solemnly betrothed, a status that requires divorce, could say to the angel with a straight face, "How could I be with child since I don't know of any man?" Third spoiler, if you are discerning a call to become a spouse of Christ, you don't need a personal witness from a religious. You can use much of the same common sense discernment that a person does who is asking whether to marry a certain person who might be a very good person, but might not be the one God has in mind. Before I begin, I might speak in the feminine tense, as if I assume that we are talking only of a female vocation. Actually, in classic theology, the soul is always feminine in relation to God, just as Israel and this church are the collective bride of Christ. It's a spiritual reality not based on physical gender. There are thousands of male religious priests and brothers who have a very different vocation from the secular clergy. All right, this is my story. You have permission to snooze because I did not have a playgirl background. I never had a conversion. There is nothing of juicy stuff to make a movie. I was baptized as an infant and raised in a committed Catholic family. I was the oldest child. Babies were arriving one after the other. The focus at home was diapers, not religious instruction. There were holy pictures around, but we children spent Sunday Mass in the cry room. I talked to God a lot in my childish way, but I didn't know much about Him. I began Catholic school in second grade. This was my first and only exposure to the Baltimore Catechism. I was so excited to learn that God made me because He loved me. The adults in my life had little time to spare for me. So it was extremely big news in my life to find out that God loved me. First Communion Day was set for Laetare Sunday, March 5th, 1967. So from September to February, I was never separated, day or night, from my beloved catechism book. Now ours was an overflow, split class. One day, Sister Josita sent us second graders to a study hall while she tended to her first graders. It so happened on that February afternoon that an eighth grade juvenile delinquent had just left the principal's office and was passing through our study hall to his classroom. Was he possessed by the devil? His eyes met mine, and he ran over to my desk, lunged for my catechism, and in front of my eyes tore it to pieces. Throwing the tattered pages in the air, he laughed like a demon and ran off. Sister Josita was very sorry, but she had no more catechisms. I knew it by heart anyway, but I cried and cried. To make matters worse, the day of my first communion involved a family conflict among the adults, which ruined the childlike happiness of the celebration. In my seven-year-old emotional evaluation of the situation, I decided that Jesus was not pleased with me and did not want me around. Everything changed the next year in third grade. Instead of the catechism, we began to study the Bible. Yahweh was wonderful. I was horrified at the ingratitude of Adam and Eve and the people of Noah's day And finally, the outrageous worship of a golden calf by people who had just crossed the Red Sea. Yahweh was so good. Why did so few people pay attention to his love? Jesus faded into the background. I never learned much about him anyway. Yahweh became the Father Abraham figure at Mass, sacrificing his beloved son on the altar. Each Mass, I was blown away by his love. I felt so lucky that we had school Mass every weekday. But the wait between Friday and Sunday Mass began to be too hard. But when I got up early to walk to my parish Mass on Saturday morning, I could see that I was attracting attention, so I didn't do it often. Happily, in fourth grade, I received a new bike for my birthday. Thenceforth, on Saturdays and summer weekdays, I could ride to Mass in the next parish where nobody knew me. St. Anthony's was the oldest church in Wichita, full of frescoes, statues, a colorful ceiling and stations, and a stocked pamphlet rack. I spent many happy hours also at the school library because I wanted to get to know the saints, to find out how to be God's friend. About this time, I was given a children's life of female saints. Saint Anne was by far the most wonderful of all. I was totally in awe of this woman. By age 9, I was the oldest of 6 siblings, so I appreciated that God had a plan for each child. But does a mother know that plan? No. Her job is to help the child to be attentive to God. But what a mission to prepare a daughter to be the mother of God. How attentively Saint Anne listened to the Spirit of Yahweh. I wanted to be like that, always attentive to Yahweh. I wasn't surprised years later to learn that Saint Anne is on a par with Saint Joseph for performing the most recorded miracles. I loved her, but I think mostly I admired her. I can't say that I dared to regard her as a friend and confidant. She was my superhero. At age 10, I became close to a Fatima promoting family. They had several daughters in my age bracket. The mother started an after-school rosary, and they invited me to join the Junior Legion of Mary. Several years later, despite my tears and pleadings, they abandoned the mainstream church to join the schismatic followers of Archbishop Lefebvre. But I am grateful for that early friendship and all the books they lent me, and the happy time I dated one of their sons in a very innocent relationship. In eighth grade, I reached a sort of crisis in my faith. Having been educated in a large, wealthy parish in the aftermath of Vatican II, there were many discussions about the best series of religion books. Each year, the parishioners would purchase a series for grades 1 through 8, and at the end of the year, they would be dissatisfied and toss out all those books to try another series. Since each series set aside 1 year for the Old Testament, it so happened that my class ended up learning Old Testament in grades 3, 4, 5, 6, and 8. In seventh grade, I didn't learn too much about Jesus because we were prepared by a Protestant teacher for confirmation. Most of the teaching sisters had disappeared from the faculty. So in eighth grade, as I was saying, I was reaching a crisis. I had begun to realize that my spirituality was Jewish. Was I a hypocrite to continue to worship in a Catholic church? Should I be attending synagogue? I told myself that in Catholic high school, I'd learn all about Jesus, and then I could decide. During that same final year of grade school, an old Polish priest was asked one day to substitute for the religion teacher. He didn't know what to do with us, so for the entire hour, he proceeded to talk about St. Therese, the little flower. I was bouncing in my chair. I had never heard of contemplative nuns. I had had a good experience with Sister Josita, an active sister, and I loved taking care of my siblings, so my heart was open to motherhood or sisterhood. But the prospect of contemplative life, of sacrificing one's life in prayer and penance to win graces for souls, was utterly new to me. It set me on fire. When the bell rang, I bolted to the library in search of the autobiography of this Carmelite. I was 13, and my father had become recently involved in a new business venture. Investors saw this hardworking route man and lured him with the prospect of becoming partial owner of his own restaurant. During my teen years, my father became partial owner of 9 Sonic drive-ins in 5 states, and this became very much a family adventure. Legally, I could earn a wage as waitress. After closing time, I accompanied my father to late-night business meetings with investors. There, I met affluent men who abounded in money and mistresses, but were destitute of religion. They were kind, sometimes generous, but I feared for their salvation. They saw the witness of my family, but it left them untouched. Good example, good books, good sermons are like water on a duck's back to people entrenched in a life of sin. To think that my life in a cloister could win grace to open closed hearts was a wild and immensely attractive prospect. 9th grade arrived, and my high school religion class proved to be a year-long course in the Old Testament. I didn't see any conflict in becoming a cloistered nun and being Jewish. But before I turned my back on Christianity, I decided that I should give Jesus a fair chance and find out who he was. So I began reading the New Testament, Aquinas, and Church Fathers. I also studied other religions with an open mind. When I turned 15, I bought a car, and this made it much easier to get away to churches for quiet times of prayer and reflection. I decided that it was too risky to become a Carmelite. It was too much of an all-or-nothing gamble. If I was a missionary sister or a teaching sister, I could do good, even if I didn't reach the heights of holiness. But if I failed to hit the mark in the cloister, my life would be a total waste. My prayers would be worth zero. I was no gambler. And being in the restaurant world, I was meeting many young men who asked me out. Something else got my attention. As a high school honor student taking Russian history as an elective in my sophomore year, I received an invitation to join several seniors on a model United Nations team. This expanded my horizons as a new way to help humanity. I threw myself into it. We competed in a mock general assembly with schools from 5 states, and our team won a small award. At the end of my junior year, I had not succeeded in ridding myself of the nagging attraction for Carmel, despite my conviction that it would be folly to go where I'd certainly fail. In a school retreat, I talked to a priest and asked him for an address. I stopped dating and corresponded with a Carmel in Wisconsin during my senior year. They sent the usual literature and told me I must have a year of college. I was struggling with my attraction for international politics, my fear that I'd be wasting my life in the cloister, and now I had learned about other orders and was feeling far more attracted to the Dominicans than to Carmel. Cloistered Dominicans devote a portion of their day to study. I wanted to know more about God. How could I pray well in Carmel without a better knowledge of the Holy Trinity? And then, from out of the blue, I was broadsided. A new congregation arrived from California to found a branch of teaching sisters in Wichita. The superior saw that I was a devout student, and she invited me to their temporary convent, which had a tiny living room that served as a parlor. Seated in an armchair, I was surrounded by eager sisters who informed me that I had a teaching vocation and should not go to Carmel. I was stunned. I would have loved to be a teaching sister. I loved books. I loved talking about God. Moreover, I had no doubts that I could succeed as a teaching sister, whereas I had no assurances about success as a Carmelite. And this is what I couldn't explain to these sisters, who should have known better, so I probably can't explain it to you. A vocation is a calling. It's not about what I want or don't want. It's not about being holy or worthy. It's simply about responding affirmatively to God's interior, persistent invitation to be his bride, or reverting to the default calling expressed to everyone in Genesis, get married, be fruitful, and multiply. I did not feel interiorly invited to become a Dominican or to join any teaching congregation. even when human beings were extending that invitation. A religious vocation is not a career. It's not like joining the military. It's not something one can choose. God chooses you or he doesn't, period. Anything else is human presumption. Woe to me, said St. Paul, if I don't preach the gospel. Jeremiah said something similar. I'm not sure exactly when I said to myself, yes, Lord, here I am, because woe to me if I don't enter Carmel. So I went off to the local college and made preparations to spend my Christmas semester break in the mandatory visit to the Carmel in Wisconsin. I was annoyed at wasting money on travel when I was sure I'd simply return home, pack my bags, and go back to Wisconsin to enter Carmel forever. But my first semester in college brought a fresh trial. I couldn't resist taking a class on international politics. And lo and behold, the professor was the longtime head of the Model United Nations who remembered me well. He began to woo me with promises to find a sponsor so that I could be trained as an ambassador to the real United Nations. My head was spinning. It was the mid-70s. We were still in a Cold War with Russia. The UN was the bastion of world peace. Such a noble career. What an interior battle it was for me. How many hours did I spend in churches begging for courage to respond to the call to go to the cloister? Finally, I told the professor that I was going to be a nun. He was Quaker. He didn't get it, but he was respectful. So the day after Christmas, I took my first plane ride. I changed planes in Chicago to board a smaller aircraft for Wisconsin. I expected to take a cab to the monastery, but as I stepped out of the plane, there on the tarmac were five nuns waving at me. What were they doing out of the cloister? And why was only one wearing a habit? And the habit didn't match the traditional garb shown on the pamphlets they had mailed me. Four of them were in jeans and sweatshirts. I was in shock. I desperately wished I could get back into the plane and fly away. But my round-trip ticket was booked for a five-day stay in Wisconsin. I smiled politely and got into the car. We nearly died several times on the road because the nun who was driving had very little experience in traffic. The next 5 days was one interrupted nightmare. Everywhere I encountered remnants of abandoned monasticism. The refectory still featured the built-in benches along the walls where the nuns used to eat in silence while they listened to sacred reading. Now a big dinner table was set up in the middle, and there was lots of chatter at mealtime. My cell had one souvenir of past days, a small backless bench that used to serve as a nun's chair. But now the cell featured a large mirror, and the trestle and straw mattress and plain brown spread were replaced with a big cozy bed with box springs. The chapter room was turned into a library with books like Gone with the Wind, a perfect title for the present state of monastic life. For Mass, we all marched past the grill to sit in the chapel with the lay people. And after Mass, the chaplain entered the enclosure to eat a merry breakfast with the nuns. But what upset me most deeply was the divine office, the center of monastic life. The choir stalls had been extracted. The nuns sat on folding chairs in a semicircle around the altar, reading the Psalms in a leisurely manner with legs crossed. I spent my days snow skiing and visiting nearby shrines with the other visiting aspirants. One evening, I was playing ping pong in the basement with the prioress. I asked her if there were any backward, old-fashioned Carmels left in the United States. Oh, a few, she lamented. I prodded her for addresses. Reluctantly, she gave me three or four. There are 65 Carmels in the USA, so I was happy to have some clues. When I returned home, it was too late to re-enroll in college, and I had no more funds anyway. I began writing to all the Carmels, but I learned that some were so backward that they rejected Vatican II and still did everything in Latin. To confound the whole sad situation, I woke up one morning and my faith was gone. as if I had never been a Christian or believed in God. I was stunned. Where was God? Gradually, it dawned on me that I had entered the classic dark night of the spirit. I spent hours sitting alone in the house, weeping near the fireplace. Yet, I didn't care too much. I missed the consolation of believing, but at the core of my being, God was God, and I was his creature. I would worship him, even if I lacked the certainty of any self-revelation on his part. Yet I had to admit that I had come to a plateau. If I were to enter a good monastery, I could no longer entrust my soul to any superior. Any human being, no matter how holy, could fall into error like the prioress in Wisconsin. I would always feel responsible to keep myself on the straight path of truth. It suddenly seemed prudent for me to get a more intense theological education before pursuing religious life. Everyone I consulted told me to go to the Jesuit college in Kansas City. This would be expensive. My parents would help with room and board, but tuition, books, auto, and insurance were on me. There weren't any scholarships for rich kids, so I took 3 waitressing jobs to work nearly 80 hours till September, mostly graveyard shifts. Once in school in Kansas City, I'd work almost full-time in a souvenir shop downtown while taking a full load of theology and philosophy during the year. It was 1977, the beginning of the great wave of modernist theology that was starting to rush through Jesuit colleges. At that date, the parents were totally clueless that the faith of their children was about to be systematically decimated by priests who explained to them that the sacred scriptures were books of codes and symbols. Jesus didn't really work miracles or give his body at the Last Supper or rise from the dead. The presentations in class were extremely subtle, unrelenting, and so persuasive that at the end of this first semester, my dark night of the spirit was fully enhanced because now my beloved Old Testament was also shrouded in darkness. Even the rabbi professor on the staff explained why all those tribes could not have crossed the Red Sea and survived 40 years in the desert. It was just a story with various moral lessons. My prayer time was very dark, very dry, but it was okay. That was the final trial of Saint Therese in her last few years. I figured it was normal for a Carmelite. I should grow up and get used to it. I would never have consolations. It was all part of the sacrifice in faith for the salvation of souls. Meanwhile, I was recommended to one of the Carmels in Missouri. Every Carmel is named for a patron saint. This was the only Carmel dedicated to Saint Anne. I drove into the Ozarks to meet the nuns. I was delighted with the community. After a year in Kansas City, with 3 semesters of college under my belt, 2 dozen hours in theology, nearly the same in philosophy and other random classes, I was close to a diploma, but I wasn't interested in being awarded for my knowledge of heresy. I headed for Missouri with my parents and my siblings, who enthusiastically supported my vocation and bade me farewell at the door of the cloister with smiles and cheers. So I finished the tale. But I'd like to append the surprise that occurred not long after I entered. The Discalced Carmelite Constitutions prescribe 2 one-hour periods of silent mental prayer, and I anticipated living till the age of 100 in a dark spiritual void. But it was like the doors of heaven opened up after I passed through the enclosure door. Pure love poured down on me in torrents. I was deeply embarrassed. Lord, go away. I want to live in pure faith. I want to sacrifice all consolations for souls like the saints. I'm okay, Lord. I don't need hugs and candy. Go away. But he wasn't budging. Joy inundated my soul. Yet, as he drew nearer, I began to experience and understand the cares on his heart, his anxiety for souls. Even though this was painful, it was so blissful being near him that joy and ecstasy were all mixed up together. Then something else happened. It was the era for updating constitutions with the new code of canon law. The nuns were experimenting with different points, and it was decided to read scripture at meals instead of other pious works. This decision greatly displeased me. My trust in Scripture had been destroyed by the Jesuits. The Bible was all in code, but we were never given the code. Why listen to nonsense? But I was a novice with no authority to object. The refectory reader opened to Genesis, and for the next 5 or 6 months, the Bible was read aloud during meals with no footnotes and no omissions. I had never heard it read continuously. In the liturgy and in class, we always focused on this or that passage. But now I was hearing the entire context surrounding those passages. It was exhilarating. Story after story, Israel tattled on its own infidelities. It was so compelling. The nuns found themselves rushing back to the next meal like one runs to a soap opera. This was no code. This was truth. After we finished the Bible, the prioress chose a different translation, and we started again at Genesis. We did that for nearly 13 years. Moreover, there was lots of free time in the Carmelite schedule for personal study. I had a library with 2,000 religious books at my disposal, and unlike the Dominicans, I could design my own curriculum and study to my heart's content. Unlike the Dominicans, I could design my own curriculum and study to my heart's content. What was it that Jesus told Peter? Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or children or lands for my name's sake will receive 100-fold and inherit eternal life. I humbly submit to you that there must be an error in that translation. The original text probably says 100,000-fold. Thank you.